From Napa Valley Wine Academy, this is The Stories Behind Wine, a podcast dedicated to the stories, people, places, and history that influence the world of wine. I'm Christian Ogenfuss, and in this episode, we bring you an interview with Andrew Jeffords, with a focus on Andrew's most recent book, Drinking with the Valkyries, published through the Académie de Vin Library. This interview is conducted by our very own Catherine Bouguet. Andrew is regarded by many as the best wine writer in the world. His works are transcendent, impeccably researched, and incredibly thoughtful. Andrew discusses finding enjoyment in affordable wine and argues that some are worthy of fine wine status. He provides authority to minerality characteristics in wine and their link, or lack of links, to soil type. Andrew provides insight into regions most are unfamiliar with, such as Liguria, Bandol, and Georgia. If you're interested in seeing a video recording of this interview, it is available as part of Napa Valley Wine Academy's annual membership. More information about the membership available at napavalleywineacademy.com/membership. If you're interested in getting your hands on the book Drinking with the Valkyries, and I highly recommend that you do, click the link available in the show notes.
I'm Catherine Bouguet, Head of Education at the Napa Valley Wine Academy, and I am beyond thrilled that we have Andrew Jeffords here with us today. We will be talking about his new book, Drinking with the Valkyries, Writings on Wine, published by the Académie de Vin Library. Jay McInerney calls Andrew an iconoclast in his foreword to this book, in that Andrew fearlessly questions industry practices. That means that this webinar is going to be good fun. He does so with a writer's skill that is greatly admired by his peers and has won many awards. Andrew writes for Decanter, World of Fine Wine, a long list of publications, as well as 12 books. Before we bring on Andrew, a note on what this latest book of his has given to us. I devoured it. I think it's high time that we go ahead and we, you know, introduce Andrew so that we can share some insight into this Venice literary adventure that he took us on in this latest book. Andrew, thank you so much for being here.
Great to be with you, Catherine. A real pleasure.
Are you ready to dive in with some questions?
Ready to dive when you are.
Good. I really feel like these questions will help give, you know, everybody watching some great insight into what you're going to find in this book. And then just, you know, a piece of Andrew's brain, which is just, you know, incredible. So let's go ahead and start with the title story, Drinking with the Valkyries. You make a case for drinking port earlier, saying you won't fully understand it unless you have tasted it young, in its ride of the Valkyries stage, when it comes hurtling out of the glass and puts the screamers on you. This advice goes against long-held standards. Why drink port in its youth?
Well, because it's fun and it's exciting, and there's nothing else in the wine world quite like that. And also, as I say, you really do come to understand the explosive nature of it, the way that it can absolutely be more packed with flavor and aroma than anything else you could ever dream of or imagine. It really is an exciting ride, a real ride of the Valkyries, or with the Valkyries, if you prefer. So I want everybody to be able to enjoy that. And to me, the classic advice of, you know, buy your case of vintage port and then, you know, wait 2 decades before you begin to tiptoe into the first bottle is really not good enough. I mean, by all means, wait 2 decades for half the case if you want, but certainly tiptoe into the first bottle after a year or two, when it's still got all this flesh clinging to it and all this power and energy inside it, and when you can really be excited by it and learn from it in a sort of analytical manner rather than pure serene appreciation, which is what you'll get when it's mature, of course.
Well, now I feel like I have to run out and drink a young port tonight. I love how in the book you equate drinking youthful port with the wine drinker's equivalent of zorbing, wing walking, base jumping. I love that. I love it.
It's as close as you'll get to those things in a glass of wine.
Well, continuing on the theme of questioning industry standards, you challenge your peers and your readers to rethink how wines are viewed and reviewed. In Curse of the Vertical, you suggest our current vertical approach to wine needs to be, as you say, locked up in a kennel, and that we should be thinking horizontally instead. Can you explain?
Sure. Well, many people watching and listening to this probably know vertical tastings and horizontal tastings. Vertical tasting is when you taste many different vintages of the same wine. Horizontal tasting is when you taste many different properties of the same vintage or the same region. Well, that's not what I mean. I'm not referring to that. What I'm referring to by vertical is the whole schema of wine hierarchies, which of course have always existed since 1855 and probably before, but which have become intensified really with the use of the 100-point scale and the ubiquity of scoring in general, scoring wines in general. So we've become acclimatized to thinking of things in terms of hierarchies of quality, the search for excellence, going up the ladder of quality, always trying to seek out, you know, a wine with an extra point or 2 points or 3 points or 4 points. To me, actually, that is not at all the point of wine. By horizontal, I mean the exploration of difference in wine. To me, the great joy of wine is difference. It's the joy of difference. It's exploring new things, exploring cultures with those new things, exploring places with those new things. And the wine world is absolutely dazzling in this respect. There's the amount of difference and nuance that you can find in wine is without limit, really. And to me, that's much more rewarding in the long run than the search after excellence is. You know, I personally believe the search after excellence is in a way based on a lie, which is that excellence is really something real. I'm not sure it is. And it's something that's objective, and I'm not sure it is that either. To me, it's subjective. It's ephemeral. It's subject to change all the time. It's subject to change both as you change as a drinker, as the weather changes, as the place changes in which you're drinking the wine, subject to all manner of change. And to me, the quest really for excellence is also a disempowering one, because the most expensive, the most highly scored wines, of course, are the most expensive wines. And most of us can't afford those wines. And we spend all our time, you know, reading all these notes about excellent wines that have 90 points, 95 points, 97 points, 98 points. And all of these notes really are pretty much irrelevant to most of us for reasons of cost, for reasons of access, for reasons of basic drinking capacity, for reasons of storage capacity, all sorts of reasons. Whereas the world of difference, which we have no way of scoring, you can't score wines for difference. You can't score wine A with a very high score because it's super different from wine B. It's a nonsense. It doesn't exist. So you can't really predicate it on any kind of scoring system. But to me, it's a much, much more rewarding way to explore the wine world, and much more meaningful, I would say, for the individual drinker. That's certainly been my experience, and that's what I'd like to convey by that point of difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you say in the book, you know, if you're scoring, there'll be losers, and you could have a lineup of great wines, yet somebody has to be, you know, on the lower end or the loser, and yet. What good is that doing? That wine, I think you even said those differences might be the very thing, as you say, that on a different day we might have appreciated most about that wine.
Indeed.
So, really, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to, I'll never, you know, we'll never see the end of scoring. It's here to stay, that's for sure. The 100 points system is here to stay. I have to score wines with points professionally. And I'm prepared to do that, of course. And I, you know, there are things you can say in favor of points. It's fun, you know, wine should be fun, that's great. And also it's quite useful sometimes as a shorthand to nuance enthusiasm. For example, you could have four or five notes, all of which seem to be quite enthusiastic about four or five wines, but the differences in score will really underscore your own particular passion or not for wine. So that, you know, you can make a case for points. It's just, to me, we've got so far into that way of thinking that we're almost destroying our own pleasure. You know, I have come across wine drinkers who are just drinking and collecting now in order to tick boxes or fill gaps or, you know, go on some kind of intellectual quest, and the whole pleasure side of things has got completely set aside. And to me, that's an enormous shame, because pleasure should be at the core of our interactions with wine.
Mm-hmm. Beautifully said. And embrace the differences, as you say.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk about the story in A Sea Interlude. You know, you liken a wine with, and I'm paraphrasing you, a lemony cascade, a saline edge, and fruity sweetness to a fruity sweet shell around a salty oyster squeezed with lemon on top. This delectable wine you describe is the backdrop for a story where you call into question staid views accepted by wine enthusiasts without question. You encourage us to question things anew. You give us something to ponder with friends as we pop open a bottle that represents that very question. And in this story, it's the question of fine wine and people de Panay. Would you share with us your view on what makes a fine wine, touching on your myth-busting opinion on less expensive co-op-driven wine?
Yeah, well, I don't think you can ever have a simple definition of a fine wine. We did try at the beginning of The World of Fine Wine magazine to come up with such definitions. I think probably the best stab at it was Hugh Johnson's, which was a fine wine is a wine worth talking about. But there can be no easy or simple or formulaic definition of what a fine is. So for me, a fine wine is a wine based on one's authentic personal experience, a wine that has special or memorable or exquisite resonances when one drinks it. And to me, a wine like Picpoul de Pinay, which is a modest wine, it's never very expensive, it's largely produced by cooperatives, about 80% of it is cooperative produced, with quite a lot of technology involved. It's not a large area, it's quite a small area of Languedoc. And it uses this particular variety, Picpoul, 100%, which you won't find in any other appellation used to that extent, although technically it would be allowed in White Chateauneuf, because it's one of the great varieties you can use for White Chateauneuf. And, of course, one of the wonderful things about the Chateauneuf appellation is you can make a varietal wine if you really want. But I don't think there are any 100% Picpoul Chateauneufs. And, you know, to me, it's a wine that people love often when they get to know it. It's been a huge success in the UK, for example. And I'm sure that many people drink that wine with such enjoyment that that wine seems to them a fine wine. Now, if you go and speak to any, you know, technically trained wine taster or anybody from the wine establishment or any French supermarket buyer, for example, those guys always work with hierarchies. Nobody will ever define Picpoul de Pinay as a fine wine in the way that they would a Chablis or a Chablis Premier Cru. And yet for me, on a personal drinking basis, the two wines are doing very similar things. They both occupy a similar kind of drinking space within the gastronomic repertoire. And I can easily imagine, you know, rounding up 20 or 30 enthusiastic wine drinkers from all walks of life and giving them a glass of Picpoul de Pinay and a glass of Chablis and asking them what they think of each. And they would find them more or less the same. They would enjoy the same sort of things about them. In fact, I once did a comparative tasting at Vintners Hall in London, in fact, for a previous magazine I worked for called Waitrose Food Illustrated, where we have Greece versus the world. It was the time of the Olympics in Athens. And we blind paired a Santorini wine with a Chablis, and the Santorini wine came out top. It beat the Chablis. Now, I'm not saying Santorini is better than Santorini Assyrtiko is better than Chablis, and I'm not saying Picpoul de Pinay is better than Chablis. Of course, they're different, but they occupy the same space within the gastronomic world, and all three, for me, can be fine wines. And I'm not in any shadow of a doubt that most drinkers would be prepared to accept that. And yet, that's something that the wine world, with all its hierarchies, will discourage you from thinking. So that's that was really my thinking behind that particular piece.
And that went straight to my heart, because in studying for the WSET diploma, I had to study all about co-ops. And there are many co-ops who produce really fine wine. In fact, you mentioned that you know, four co-ops produce over 80% of the peak pool. And you share with us that they're all careful vinifiers, cool temperature, lees contact, block mallow. I mean, they're taking care, you know, with this production. So this story hit home, you know, with me very much so.
Yes. And in fact, you know, it's not the only cooperative wine that I write up in semi-rhapsodic terms in the book. There's also Produttori del Barbaresco, a wine from them that I write up. There's Saint-Mont, Plate Producteur Plémont from Saint-Mont too. So there are two or three other co-op produced wines that I'm very keen on and write about in the book as well.
Mm, I love that. You also share in your book your perception of what wine really is about. You know, and in your story, wine is also a dream. You write that humans overcomplicate wine, and in that there is fallibility with expert judgments and competition results. And what matters most, really, in fact, about wine, what we trade, collect, and write about, you know, with wine, as you say in the story, is something else entirely. Would you tell us what this is?
Yes. Well, you know, if you imagine all the wines you're going to drink in the next year being lined up in front of you in little medicine bottles with numbers, you know, on marked on the bottle and nothing else. That's it. Nothing else. Just numbers in medicine bottles. Are you going to enjoy those wines as much as you will opening the bottles you will open with the labels on them, with the stories that you've learnt about them, with everything you've learnt about the appellation and every nuance that you understand from the terroir, and further on than that, with all the significance that wine has within Western culture more generally, bearing in mind that Homer's Odyssey is full of wine drinking episodes, very significant to the plot at several points, and that was written between the 7th and the 8th centuries BC, bearing in mind that perhaps the greatest Greek tragedy of all, the Bacchae by Euripides, written just over 400 years BC, you know, obviously is all about Dionysus and Bacchic ritual and wine and so on. Bearing in mind the significance of wine in the New Testament, you know, the parable of the wedding at Cana, the Christian Eucharist, all of that. You know, we're not thinking about all of these things literally when we're sitting down to taste our glass of Picpoul de Pinay, but they're all there in the back, hovering over everything, all of our engagements and our interactions with wine. And those, based on this little phrase of Philippe Guigal, which is where wine is also a dream comes from, those to me are the dream force behind the wine. And actually, if you stripped away all of that dream force from every wine, you wouldn't enjoy the wine anything like as much as you're going to enjoy it. So a part of what we're buying with every wine is its dream force. And we couldn't really enjoy that wine in the same way, and perhaps even at all, without that dream force. So wine is also a dream. When we buy wine, we buy the dreams of wine with it. And those dreams are as significant to us, as nourishing to us, as rich a source of pleasure to us as the wine itself. And I just, you know, once Philippe Guigal had said this phrase, and once I went back to the hotel and I thought about it, it just began to seem more and more significant. And now I often think about that. And indeed, Wine is Also a Dream was my own personal choice for the title of the book. In the end, the publishers preferred Drinking with the Valkyries, and we went for that, and that's fine, and it's good fun. But Wine is Also a Dream is really absolutely a core piece in the book for me, and it's something I think very significant. And I think everybody would do well to think a little bit more about that, and then a little bit less about all the kind of the geeky stuff and the points, which to me is a much, much less important a part of the character of a wine than that dream force actually is.
Thank you for sharing that with us. In fact, in your story, Angela's Lemon, it's just one of the stories that very much moved me in the book after reading it. The story I'll share a little bit with our viewers, but the story starts with a lemon in front of you and then whirls into a description of the impossibly beautiful location of Cinque Terre, where the terraced vineyards are a stairway from sea to sky, as you say. We get a brief history of the growing area, trellising. We're always learning something from you. And then we meet Angela, an 82-year-old wine grower tending vines, and I quote from you, 300 meters above the fishes, surrounded by wild oregano, wild asparagus, and sweet-scented heather tree. The story has a bittersweet ending in more ways than one. Would you explain the issues at hand? And then, having fallen in love with Cinque Terre through your story, tell us, is there any hope for the region, like a Priorat type rebirth?
Yeah, well, very interesting question. It is an absolutely wonderful area to go and visit. I'm sure some of the people tuning in today will have been there, but if you haven't ever been there and you had the chance to go and visit that particular area, Liguria, go and visit Cinque Terre, I strongly recommend you do. It's an amazing sight. Very, very steep vineyards rising up directly from the ocean. And until they brought the trains in I think the 1950s, it was only accessible by sea or by foot. That was the only way. And all the villages are along the bottom, and then you get all the terraces right up to the top. And of course, the vineyards were traditionally up on the terraces. The whole zone is about, I'm sorry, I'm going to give you hectares, but remember 2.47, so multiply by that to make acres. It's about 3,860 hectares, the total zone. The terraces are about 1,400 hectares. The vineyards were about 500 hectares, but now they're down to about 80 hectares and falling all the time. And the problem is that it's really so hard to cultivate those vines. You have to walk up or down. There are little funicular railways, as in Switzerland, that will take you up and down now. But more and more people who own the vineyard sometimes aren't even aware they own the vineyard. It's often in family holdings that have been passed on. What generation one still works the vines, generation two doesn't work them anymore, but they know where the vineyards are. Generation three doesn't even know where the vineyards are. So they're all gradually being taken over by the tree heather. And it's very sad in one sense because it's a unique wine made from wonderful grape varieties with a fantastic tradition behind it. Angela was a lady in her 80s, I believe. Was it 80s? I can't remember. 60s, 70s or 80s. Anyway, an elderly lady who walked up and down every time she came up to her vineyards. I just happened to meet her when I went there and chatted to her. And of course, her children, you know, now work in offices and they're unlikely ever to take over the vineyard from her. And it, you know, that little meeting really summed up the predicament of the whole area as a vineyard area. But then I thought, well, wait a minute, you know, these are people who have they have the right to make whatever choices they want about their lives. There's nothing that says that absolutely, you know, cultivating vineyards is morally a better thing to do than working in an insurance office or working in one of the hotels down at the bottom of the hill. So if that's the way it's going to go, then that's the way it's going to go. We just have to accept that. But it did seem a sort of bittersweet thing to have to accept. And Angela gave me the lemon and said, these lemons are so sweet that you can sit and peel and eat one on its own. And it seemed to be, the lemons seemed to sort of stand somehow for the whole predicament of Cinque Terre, this bittersweet reality that we just had to accept one way or the other. Now, you ask if it'll ever go the way of Priorat and be recovered. Well, I'm not saying it won't, but, things have gone quite far. It would really need, I was thinking about this having seen your question, and it seemed to me that the only way you could make it work was doing what the Swiss have done with their vineyards, using a lot of mechanization to get up and down, and being able to charge 30 or 40 euros a bottle for quite simple wine. which they can do in Switzerland because they're being bought by Swiss, who are very wealthy people. Whether Cinque Terre can ever try and pull something off like that, I'm not too sure. I really don't know. Somehow I doubt it. But that for me would be the only chance. Priorat is a different example because it's a much bigger area. You're talking about serious gastronomic red wines, which can easily command 80 or 90 euros a bottle at the top level, which I don't think Cinque Terre ever could. So, the analogy really is spectacularly scenically grown Gamay or Haider or something in Switzerland. And perhaps we can see something like that in the future. Perhaps we can't. I just don't know.
I'll hold out a little bit of hope. I mean, just because it is so bittersweet and the story was just so beautifully written. Let's continue on and talk about the Blue Corruptor, where you question, where you would buy if you came into a large sum of money and set out to purchase a vineyard. And Bandol sprung to your mind. You say it may well be the greatest site in the world for an important red grape variety. Would you share your thoughts on why this is so, the grape, the struggles of Bandol, a plight I'd actually love more people to know about?
Well, Bandol is a wonderful area near the little town of Bandol, which itself is near the town of Toulon in Provence, coastal zone, sort of amphitheater, not wildly dissimilar to Cinque Terre, but an amphitheater set back from the sea with terraces, which are called restanques. In the area. And the grape variety to which you alluded, Catherine, is Mourvèdre, Monastrell in Spain, very well suited to the Mediterranean, even in times of climate change, I ought to say. Quite often grown in Languedoc, but actually often it doesn't quite get ripe enough, whereas in Bandol it certainly does get ripe enough. It loves the very coastal location. It's one of those varieties they say it always likes to look at the sea. And it also likes generally a summer storm or two in August, which it tends to get in Bandol, which it often wouldn't, for example, a little bit further inland. So very well suited to where it is. And to my way of thinking, the greatest Bandol I've had are the greatest wines I've ever had from Mourvèdre anywhere, including Monastrell from Spain. I'm always ready to review that verdict, but that's true from what I've tasted so far. Okay, you think, well, what's the problem there? That's fantastic. Well, the problem is that we're in coastal Provence. The yachts are bobbing up and down in the harbour, full of holidaymakers, with everything that goes with that. And what does go with that? Well, first of all, extraordinary pressure on the land. So it's very hard to keep the vineyard as vineyard. And secondly, what do people want to drink there? Hey, guess, they want to drink rosé. And Bandol, you can make rosé. In fact, it's jolly good rosé. It's among the most gastronomic of all rosés because it's based on Mourvèdre rather than on Sasso and Grenache and so on. And it has a very distinctive clay limestone terroir. You're taking the greatest vineyard land in the world, perhaps, for Mourvèdre, and you're using it to make rosé. And whatever you say about rosé, and I'm a big fan of rosé from Provence, and I love judging rosé, and it's an extraordinary challenge, and it's got a lot to be said for it that hasn't yet been said for it, but it's still not the same as a great red wine that you could age for 20 or 30 years and drink at the end of that as an extraordinary and unique gastronomic experience. And Bandol is now over 50% rosé, rising all the time, and it's not, I'm sure they'll carry on making red wine there, but it might only be 10 or 20% of the appellation. And it seems to me an awful shame, really. So the Blue Corruptor is the glittering blue Mediterranean that you can see from the vineyards and that makes everybody so happy when they're there on holiday. But it's corrupted the vineyard by putting it under enormous pressure from housing and other developmental endeavors, and also by making it produce so much rosé when it could be producing wonderful red wine.
It really hit home when you mentioned that only 30% of the wine produced is red. Really hit home.
Yeah, they have white as well. That's right. Yeah.
Let's talk about a different party. In The Party's Over, your story, you talk about the relationship between rock, soil, and wine flavor. Where tasting notes today are heavy with liquid rock, flint, and other soil-related terms. You say, into this exciting, if dangerous environment, steps a dark figure with a whistle. Tell us why you advise we pay heed to the whistle and wield these terms with care.
Well, let me first of all tell you who the dark figure is. Professor Alex Maltman, Professor Emeritus at Aberystwyth University, Professor of Earth Sciences, a geologist, but also a wine-loving geologist. He's cultivated his own vineyards in Wales for many years, and a thoroughgoing and pure-minded scientist, and somebody who cares actually an awful lot about language too, and about the precise use of language. And you know what he points out in his work. He has written a book and written many articles, including many very interesting articles for both Decanter and for the World of Fine Wine. You know, he points out that there are no soil minerals in wine. There's no possible line of direct transmission from soil minerals to grape juice, and indeed, organic matter in finished wine is less than 0.02%, and it has no flavor anyway. Quartz has no flavor or aroma. Granite has no flavor or aroma. There are flavors and aromas of soil and of rocks, but they're generally coming from the organic matter with which those rocks are coated. And obviously, organic matter is a significant part of soil too. So the famous petrichor, the smell of soil after rain, is essentially the rain wetting the organic matter in the soil, not the inorganic matter, not the minerals. And so Alex has been at some pains to point that out. He's a broad-minded guy. He doesn't say that it doesn't mean that everything that we say about soil minerals affecting terroir may not be true. It may be true. It's just it's not true in the rather simplistic way we assume it to be true. In other words, we look at schist in Saint-Chinian or in the Douro, and we taste non-fruity flavors in Saint-Chinian or in Douro wine or in port, and we say, oh, well, there it is, the schist, that's what we can taste. But it's not. It cannot be. There's no way it can be. It's something else going on, which we don't fully yet understand. So it's a call for a nuanced understanding. I'd say that's what it is principally.
Mm. Well, I thank you for introducing me to Professor Maltman. Just, you know, his name, wanting to read, you know, more of him now that, you know, I've read this from you.
Yeah. I mean, I've got his, let me just, here it is. Here's the book, if I can show you. Yeah, Vineyards, Rocks, and Soils, The Wine Lover's Guide to Geology. That will help you on that particular topic. I have written the foreword to that book, but entirely unpaid, so... No personal direct interest at all. I'm just a good friend of Alex and a great admirer of his work and somebody who's learned a lot from him myself.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. And didn't you write something for, was it World of Fine Wine?
He has written a lot of very interesting articles on different rock types and soil types for the World of Fine Wine. That's quite true.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, there's so much other, you know, there's other stories that are so thought-provoking. I'd love to cover, let me see how we're doing with time. I'd love to cover quite a few more. Of jellyfish and guardsmen, in that story, you discuss two very different styles of tannat and make a case against centering wine knowledge on the grape variety. You say we pay lip service to place and origin, but we continue to organize our wine thinking around the varietal model. Would you explain why you believe that our fetish with grape varieties is a disservice to our appreciation of wine?
Sure. Well, you know, by the fact that we're continually choosing wine as varietal wine on the basis of its variety, we're actually failing very often to understand what it is that we're putting into our glass. That's the nub of it. The particular example I give of Tannat, I mean, obviously strikingly different in the two examples I give, one from Central Valley in California and one from its origins down in Gascony and Saint-Mont. Completely different wines in each place, so different that it's really hard to imagine that they could come from the same variety. And you know, that sort of really underlines the point. They come from a place. It's a variety that's interpreting the place. The variety is just the instrument on which you play the music of place, if you like. And it's the music that counts. It's not the instrument that counts. It's the music that counts. And the wine world is full of examples like this. I mean, you could also have chosen Uruguay, Tannat from Uruguay, for example. Another very good example is Malbec from Argentina and from Cahors. Then, you know, the classic example, which everybody will be familiar with who's watching this, I'm sure, is Cabernet Sauvignon from, you know, from Pauillac or from Saint-Estèphe compared to Cabernet Sauvignon from Napa. Now, you're not really tasting the same thing at all. You're tasting the wine of two places. And the point to try and understand those wines is to forget about the variety. I say at the end, it's at best the third most important thing. The most important thing is place. And the second most important thing is the traditions of place, the way that people interact with their variety in that place. What we're really interested in wine is the search for distinguished places in which to make wine. And varieties are just a tool for arriving at and understanding that particular distinction.
Let's see. I would love to talk about the antidote. So your story about Maderon, right? You call the tasting of a certain Maderon an event in your life. And follow that up with the comment, I'll be surprised if there's a wine I actually enjoy more than this all year. So you make a great case for Maderon in the story. And I'd love for you to share a bit of this with our viewers today.
Yes. Well, you know, Maderon is rarely an expensive wine. It's a wine from Southwest France. It's a wine made from Tannat that we've just been talking about. It can be quite a fierce wine. It's usually prolific in both tannin and acidity. But it's a wine that somebody who loves tannin, and we could perhaps talk about that. There's another piece about tannin in the book. To me, tannin is extraordinarily significant for red wines in general. To me, it's where the personality very often of a red wine lies, inside the tannins. So I'm very interested in tannins and tannic wines in general. And this particular wine was a wine, you know, it had cost me a very modest amount of money. It had been lying around in a cellar, and not in a cellar, rather in the wine rack in our house, which didn't have a cellar for some time. And I hadn't, you know, made any special arrangements. I didn't have any special expectations of it. And then I tried it towards the end of a November one day, and it was just so good, so fine. So perfect, so everything that I needed at that point. And this is why I like to stress the personal experience of wine, and why I'm rather skeptical of hierarchies and points and all the rest, because in pure point terms, no self-respecting critic is going to give it, you know, more than 91 points at the very best. But when I tasted that wine, it was easily worth 95 or 96 in terms of the pleasure it gave me. You know, it made me think that there are many other wines like that, in personal terms, when you drink them at the time, based on what you're feeling like, based on the weather, based on the light outside, based on all sorts of factors that are, you know, tangential and liable to change and unpredictable and all the rest, felicitous, if you like. But, such wines can really be something, can be events in our lives. You could say that about other wines. Marcillac, for example, another wine from Southwest France, little known, but that has wonderful individual style and character. You know, Gigondas from the Rhone, Picpoul de Pinay itself, Cahors, you know, lots of them around France. And I'm sure fans of Italian wine will know the same thing from various wines in Italy and Spain too, and California and Argentina, no doubt too, for those that know those well. So it's really just once again to emphasize this personal relationship, which to me it's so important to develop with wine, and this openness to wine's difference and to everything that implies, and the potential for pleasure that lie in those. That's what I was trying to draw people's attention to in that piece.
You know, that sort of harkens back to what a fine wine is all about. And for that wine, it was what it gave you at that time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And thank you for those other examples. I wish it wasn't just, you know, noon and it was time for a glass of wine over here.
Yeah.
I'd love to talk about the story titled Bags, Butter, and Biscuits. You give us tasting advice and encourage us to open our minds to the wider possibility of what a wine suggests. Wine could be like a landscape, as when you compare natural wine and non-interventionism to forests and uplands, or you compare a young wine to a liquid pug dog, as you say, comes yapping and tumbling out to perform delightful party tricks the moment we pull the cork. Or another, I have to just say another favorite, in Bathing Without Washing, where you're tasting an unctuous tongue-coating white. It's blind. You don't know what it is. And the image that comes to mind is of a cherished carpet. It's close grained, seamless, dense with work. I'd love for you to tell us which wine evoked this carpet comparison and how these connections come to you, sort of writing advice for, you know, any of our viewers.
Sure. Well, the latter wine that we were talking about in the Bathing Without Washing piece was actually a wine that I've only ever tasted once in my life, and this was the one occasion. And it was served blind, and I had no idea what it was, other than that it was obviously from somewhere warm and southern. And that was Chateau Rayas Blanc, actually a very expensive wine and quite a rare wine too. But I was served that by friends in Riga at a wonderful dinner. And I'm often challenged at those dinners about what to do when it comes to tasting notes, because obviously in a way you taste a wonderful wine, you want to sort of write a wonderful tasting note, and yet nothing could be less social or ruder to the other people around the table than sitting down and doing that. So very often under those circumstances, I either write nothing at all and just try and remember it and jot some things down about it before I go to bed after the dinner, or just write a few words which I'll then work up later. And in fact, so far as I remember, in the instance you've just pulled out, Catherine, it was only later on when I was thinking about that wine all over again that the carpet analogy actually came to mind. And it made sense, because what I particularly remember about this wine was its sort of the texture almost more than the flavor. It had this wonderful, smooth, rich, unctuous, balm-like texture. And I particularly noted that because I'd just done a very long stint of tasting, about 3 or 4 weeks of tasting, quite hard tasting, and my tongue was pretty sore. And it was like unction, salving the tongue. And this image of the carpet, which when you run your hand over the carpet, feels soft, uniform, very gentle to the touch, very gratifying to feel. So texturally, you can't feel any work going on there at all. I mean, it's absolutely seamless. And then when you look at the pattern, then suddenly you see the work. And it was almost as if everything I was feeling about the wine was exactly what you would feel like as you touch the carpet. But when you actually began to examine the flavors and what was in there, you began to see the work and the detail that had gone into the wine. So that was actually how that analogy came to mind. But you ask for advice. I mean, my advice really to anybody who wants to write exciting tasting notes, and I mean exciting for you, for the person actually engaged with the wine on a personal basis. I'm not actually talking about necessarily winning over the hearts and minds of huge numbers of readers or anything like that. I would say that just always let your imagination go full tilt in whatever direction it wants to go in. And in terms of what you read and what you're influenced by, try to actually steer clear of a lot of wine writing and any sort of writing that about any subject that inspires you. It could be sports writing. I often listen to music criticism. There's a program on radio, BBC Radio 3, on every Saturday morning called Record Review, and you hear critics talking about different performances of music, and the terms they often use about music also strike me as being very similar to the best sort of wine writing. So as I say, try and keep your mind as open as possible. Don't worry about being thought pretentious or any of those things. Those are just terms that jealous Philistines use about writing that they can't quite match. Just let yourself go and try to avoid long lists. That's the other thing. Try and create a harmonious single metaphor which you can work at in different directions, rather than just, you know, a huge long list of possible possible triggers, because those things are always very boring to read, I think.
Thank you so much for that advice. I'd love to talk about, you know, in one of your stories, you do something so well. In Dr. Mistral, there's gold for wine students. There's a more in-depth description, you know, of the Mistral wines than I've ever read. You teach us many things here. Flowering at high winds, not necessarily being tied to crop set issues. The Grenache's couleur threat happening in calm wind as well as high wind. I mean, it's just, these are things that, you know, it sort of go against a lot of what I've read. It goes more into depth. Would you tell us more about this?
Sure. Well, you know, I'd always read about the Mistral, particularly with Châteauneuf. And, you know, the way people wrote about it was always as if it was something negative or bad or dangerous. And yet it's such a significant part of the weather pattern in Avignon. And by the way, over in Roussillon as well, although it's called the Tramontane, the wind at that point, that I thought this just can't be right. I mean, the Mistral is an intimate part of the terroir of Châteauneuf, for sure, absolutely for sure. So I went off to Châteauneuf and tried to find out from people there about it, bad things and good things. And in fact, the more people spoke about it, the more you realize that there really weren't that many bad things about it. Other than that, it is very irritating for human beings to put up with over extended periods. And, you know, after 5 or 6 or 7 days of it, you can be going mad. But in terms of what it does to the vines, I mean, it's a drying wind. So it's very healthy for the vines. If you have any problems with fungal disease, they'll immediately stop when you have a good, strong Mistral. Obviously, in summer, it helps mitigate summer heat. It's a wind comes from the north. It's a cooling wind. So that's a positive factor. It's very good at keeping frosts away from the vineyards, of course. And the real proof of how helpful it is, really, is the fact that Châteauneuf is perhaps, I'm saying this without any statistical backup, but just based on the kind of hunch and what I've observed, it's perhaps the area with the highest percentages of old vines anywhere in France. So the vines obviously like it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be living to that great long age that they're living to. And it also encouraged me to discover about, you know, what conditions create the Mistral. It's created by air pressure differentials between the Bay of Biscay and the Gulf of Genoa. And I also learned that, you know, I'd assume that the Mistral came screaming down the Rhone Valley, the whole Rhone Valley, and therefore the northern Rhone was as affected by the Mistral as the south. And in fact, it was Philippe Guigal that told me that wasn't true at all, because the Mistral is at a much higher level when it's in the northern Rhone. It only comes down to, as it were, vine level in the southern Rhone. So it's particularly the southern Rhone that's affected by it. But it's certainly a factor in making Châteauneuf wines taste as they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much for that. I mean, just incredible learning, you know, as well in this book, besides all of this sort of thought-provoking topics. I'd like to take, since we're coming up towards the hour, and I know it's late in France for you, I'll take a few questions that are coming in. One of them is about the country of Georgia. There is recent hype around Georgia as a wine country. Do you think they are an important region to know?
Yes, I do think it's important to know about Georgia for several reasons. One is that, along with Italy and Portugal, it's one of the world's great genetic repositories of grapevine material. The Georgians have something like 500 separate indigenous varieties. Very few of them are actually used to any great extent at the moment, but nonetheless, they're there, and they're a wonderful patrimony for viticultural researchers to draw on for the future. Another reason really is that from what we know at the moment, it does seem as if Georgia is probably the cradle of wine. You know, and that matters to us emotionally. I wouldn't say it has any practical implications, but it matters to us emotionally. The oldest pure wine residues that have been found anywhere in the world on archaeological remains date back 8,000 years and to two villages in Georgia. And then, of course, Georgian winemaking traditions are fascinating. Probably most people know what Kveveri wines are. That's wines produced in buried clay jars, often very large, and in particular white wines produced with all of their stems and skins. So giving you a very different flavor profile and texture profile and aromatic profile as well, too, of course, to conventional white wines, often called amber wines, or sometimes when they're made elsewhere called orange wines, too. So that's a very important part of the Georgian tradition as well. And also, it's a country where the wine and winemaking and wine growing is enormously significant in everybody's lives. It's something that everybody does there. And it's very close to Georgia's sense of identity. The symbol of Georgia is this Nino's cross, which is based on vine material. And Georgian soldiers are always meant to carry vine seeds in their pockets. So if they're shot and killed, a vine will grow where they died. It's wine central, as I say in the piece in the book. So for all of those reasons and many more too, it's the wines are often great value at this stage. Yes, I'd urge everybody listening to try and explore some Georgian wine if they can.
That's on the top of my list. We're getting a lot of questions about what you're writing next. Let's see, questions about the new France. Anything, updates, anything else?
Well, I do hope to go back to France as a topic for a future book. I'm probably not going to rewrite the New France or do a new edition. It would be a slightly different book. Yes, I would like to do that. If this book's a success, that will give me the wherewithal to go on and write another one on France. I would like to do that very much.
You have fans of your writing style, and so we have a viewer who would like to know if did you do any training in journalism or in writing?
That's a very interesting question, it leads to a little anecdote, which I'll just tell you if I may. I studied literature for 6 years in university, 3 years as an undergraduate, 3 years as a postgraduate. And then I was unemployed for a while, and then I got a job in a wine shop. And after that, I ended up with a job in publishing as an editor. It was a mass market publishing house. They were getting hold of B and C list celebs to write books on this, that, and the other, cats, dreams, motorcars, golf, whatever. And I used to have to sort of get to work on these texts and make them read well. And very often we'd commission the book from the celeb in question. With a deadline, of course. And I used to sort of mark in my diary about 2 weeks before the deadline, because I knew I'd then get a telephone call from the author saying, not getting on too well. Can we have a chat? Can you help a bit? And so the end result was that I spent 4 years working on car crash sentences, trying to sort them out and put them right and get the grammar correct and try and pile the sentences up so they proceeded in a logical order, and really basic mechanics on poorly written sentences. And the truth is, I learned much, much, much more about how to write well in the 4 years working on the car crash sentences than I ever did in the 6 years of studying Shakespeare and Milton and all those other wonderful, wonderful writers. So that was how I learned to write well, by fixing other people's badly crashed sentences.
I worked for years at Random House with a lot of different editors, so I understand that pain point. Let's see. I know we're coming on the top of the hour, so I'll take one last question. And that question is, I'd like to know what is your desert island wine? I think you've mentioned a few of them here today, but do you have another wine in mind, your desert island wine?
All right, well, let's choose one I haven't mentioned, and that would be Pomerol, made from the Merlot grape variety. Not that that matters much, because you can take Merlot off to South Africa and make anything like Pomerol at all. For a big treat, most things we've been talking about have been fairly accessible and not expensive wines, Picpoul de Pinay, Madiron, and so on. For a big treat, a bottle of Pomerol is absolutely delicious and very lovely, and I'd be very happy sipping that on my desert island, at least until it was gone.
I love that. I think, you know, I'd like to sign us off with, you know, another quote from you. In Lessons from the Laureate, you note a kinship between what a great author gives the reader and what a winemaker gives to the drinker, saying, "A great wine can rouse in us a compassion and a loving engagement with the natural world itself, akin to the comparison that novelists evoke in us for their characters. We are richer for the experience, as when we are close to the final page of a great novel." And I just have to say, and I add to that, or come to the end of one of Andrew Jefford's stories. I can't tell viewers enough that I read stories and I laughed. I read stories and I had goosebumps. The writing is just incredible and I learned so much. So I cannot thank you enough for being here with us with the Napa Valley Wine Academy today.
Well, it's been a great, great pleasure, Catherine. Thank you so much for asking me. I've loved it.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Stories Behind Wine. If you would like to suggest an interview subject or show topic, please email us at sbh@napavalleywineacademy.com. Again, that email address is sbh@napavalleywineacademy.com. If you like what you've heard, we hope that you'll visit our website, napavalleywineacademy.com/podcast, and share us with your friends and colleagues. We'd also really appreciate a positive review on iTunes. It really helps out. Be sure to check out the archive section on our website for previous episodes and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at NapaValleyWineAcademy.com. Join us next time for another episode of The Stories Behind Wine. Until then, thank you for listening.